I brought the program up here because I get nervous and I thought I might forget Jan's name, so I said I was going to read it off of here. I did get to hear Jan share, that was October, at Jekyll Island at the Georgia Prepaid AA Convention, and enjoyed that very, very much and got to speak to her just a little bit, actually before and after her talk, and so I was real happy when Frances told me that Jan had so graciously said she would come here today. And I got to know her a little bit last night at dinner, and we immediately bonded when she got her food and she had rice instead of potatoes, and I thought she'd ordered potatoes, so I wanted to fix that for her. And she understood. So we knew immediately we were sisters in this program. No problem there. She has a great story to tell, and it's a wonderful Al-Anon story, and she has a great laugh. And we're going to hear a very good spiritual message in this. And we were at an Al-Anon convention not too long ago, and my friend Lindsay said, after one of the Al-Anon speakers, she said, "We have all shared here today in a secret that only us that are here know, and we have bonded together through this experience." And that's what we're about to do. So with that, I give you Jan C. from Houston, Texas.
Okay, can I do this? Well, it didn't work. Okay, I wish you would have left that program up here so I could remember my name. My name is Jan Case, and I'm a very, very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. And it is such an honor to be here today. And I want to thank Frances and the committee for inviting me. It is always an honor when I'm asked to do anything in Al-Anon. But to share at this level is really special. And thank you so much for the invitation. And thanks for inviting my husband. That was just real special. Particularly because he has to carry my bags around. I carried his baggage around for a long time. Bill, stand up, please. Okay, Earl, get me a box to stand on.
I don't know if it does come down. We'll just tilt it down like that. Right. Or I know, here, we just do this.
Good.
All right. Don't be afraid.
Hey, all right. Anyway, Charlene talked about her Al-Anon group as being the best. I think probably it is the second best because mine is the best. It really is. We have great Al-Anon in Texas, particularly in Houston. And I want to tell you a story about the level of Al-Anon that we do have in Houston. Are there any alcoholic doctors here? There's a couple. Good, good. Well, we have an alcoholic doctor that's friends with us all. Anyway, one of the alcoholics went to make his visit, annual visit with the doctor, and after the physical, the doctor excused him and said to the Al-Anon wife, "Could I see you for just a minute by yourself?" And she said, "Well, certainly." And he said, "Sit down." He said, "I have some bad news for you." He said, "It looks like Clarence is not going to make it another year." And she said, "Oh, no, what is wrong?" And he said, "Well, there's a number of things wrong, but," he said, I believe with your help we can make him okay." And she said, "Well, what is it I can do?" And he said, "Well, if you would get up every morning and fix him a nice breakfast. And after he eats breakfast, he must lay down for a while and rest and watch whatever television would make him happy." And she said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "And then you must fix him a nice lunch." He said, "He's tired of sandwiches, and they aren't good for his physical condition, so you must fix him a nice lunch. And after that, he'll have to take a little rest." And she said, "And?" And he said, "And then fix him a nice dinner." He said, "I know that you've been running out to the cafeterias a lot, and he needs nice home-cooked meals. And after that, he'll rest a while before he goes to bed. And he said, and the other thing is, he must have sex whenever he wants it. As they got in the car, the alcoholic said to his lovely Al-Anon wife, and what did the doctor say to you? And she said, he said, you're going to die. That's what kind of Al-Anon we have in Houston. Anyway, I want to acknowledge and thank also Charlene and Don. We had such a good time with they and Jerry and Francis at dinner last night. Our day yesterday was just unbelievable. We got here probably 5 minutes before dinner reservations, and I had to change clothes because I had mustard on my blouse. Whenever we go anywhere, Bill tells me that it's not, you know, when I'm ready to pack, he said, it's not how many days we're going to be gone, it's how many meals we're going to eat. So I had to get rid of the mustard-stained shirt and find some earrings, and it took me 5 minutes, and we were on time, and we got there, and it was wonderful. Thank you. I want to acknowledge my God and my sponsor and my home group, because without any of those three, you would not have me here as a speaker today, and I know that. I come from a long list of alcoholics. My father was an alcoholic. My ex-son-in-law, he may be my son-in-law still, I don't know. I have two alcoholic children. I have either two or three times married an alcoholic. It depends on how you count. Aunts and uncles. I mean, I have a whole list of alcoholics that are in my have been in my lineage. Anyway, you know, those people are not what make me an Al-Anon. What makes me an Al-Anon today is because I love the program of Al-Anon. I try to practice it to the best of my ability every day of my life. I work the Al-Anon steps, and I have an Al-Anon sponsor. And that's what makes me an Al-Anon. You know, I get a real attitude about these people who refer to their spouse as my Al-Anon, you know. They're not your Al-Anon, you know. You can sit in a car in a garage all day, and you're not going to be a car, you know. And so, what you need to do is you need to be part of the Al-Anon program to be called an Al-Anon. Now I've got that little bit out of the way. We'll get on with it. We're asked to share in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we are like today. And folks, if you could have seen me then, what a mess and what a miracle I am today. I have not always been this lovely lady that you see up here today. I remember one time, it was while I was... a lot of times through my life, what I tried to do was to become different so he would stop drinking. You know, and I know if you're an Al-Anon, you understand that. And I was very, very much like a chameleon on a plaid skirt. You know, whatever he wanted me to be, I would be for that day. And it would make him stop drinking. So this particular time, he had seen a stately blonde that lived across the street from us, and he had made some mention of her. So I thought, if I could just become this woman, you know, who was tall, blonde, and stacked, he would stop drinking. So, you know, I raised myself up with high heels to my full height of 5 feet, and I bleached this red hair blonde, and... this was when I was much younger, and in those days they had these circle stitched maiden form bras, you know. And I mean, I just looked like I had two little torpedo tips out there. You know, and that was gonna make him stop drinking, you know. I mean, I had it all together before Madonna ever had that idea. But I can tell you now that that did not keep him from drinking, nor did any of the other things I did keep him from drinking. And in Texas, what we say is that it's a whole lot like teaching a pig to sing to try and get an alcoholic sober. You know, you can't do it, and it just annoys the pig. But I tried all of that. I tried all of that. I tried, I tried nagging. I tried not nagging. I tried being kind to him. I tried ignoring him. There was everything that I tried. I know that you have tried, too. He had bedroom privileges. He didn't, you know. Just like an alcoholic, you know, when they try and cut down and change the way of their drinking. Well, that's exactly what I did with my life, was just, if I could just hit on the right combination of things, he would quit drinking, and we would be happy. But you see, from the very first memory I have when I was a child, I was 6 years old, I guess, 5 or 6 years old when I went into the first grade. And my father was an alcoholic, as I told you. Anyway, I went to the first grade, and they passed out this little ditto sheet, this purple ditto sheet. And I know that there's some of you that have no idea what I'm talking about. But they did have ditto machines way back then. And it was a bunny, and we were supposed to color it. Now, I have a sister that's 2 years older than I, and she thought it was her God-given responsibility to teach me everything that she knew. So she had gone to school 2 years earlier, and she had learned to color better than I. So she came home, and she tutored me on coloring. And so I outlined the bunny very carefully, just like she had taught me, and I colored with nice, even strokes, just like she had taught me, and I did not go out of the lines. And then when I was finished, I drew a structure in the background with the house and a chimney and windows, and then I put a sign across the structure, and I lettered in TAVERN. Now, the reason I knew how to spell that was because that's where the yellow pages were turned to in my home, and that was so my mother could find my father. And it did not get the results that I expected, which was kind of the story of my life, and maybe that's why I remember it. But I think that story really tells a lot about me at that age. See, we didn't have to draw anything in the background, but I had to, you see, because I had to go a little bit further. I had to try a little bit harder. I had to work on being perfect so that I could feel okay and average. And that wasn't the result I got. I got in trouble, I do remember that, because I didn't know that tavern was a bad word, because it was normal at our house, you see. And so there was the confusion there. I thought I had done something good, and it turned out it wasn't all that good. And there was that confusion, and I did continue to do that throughout my life, too, doing the things that I thought were right and getting different results and being confused as to why. But that's how my mother found my father. You know, she would track him down. Now, I know today that she did that so that she could get the money from him. You know, he had the money, and those were the days when women did not work, and she didn't have a lot of choices. And I understand that today more than I did then. but I learned from her. And I didn't realize until alcoholism came into my life again when I got married. But it was like I had to find him, you know? I had to find him. I always did, you know? I always found him. It was like Winnie Eddy, she is an old-time Al-Anon that is no longer with us. Anyway, she would say, you just put your nose to the wind and follow. And and I would do that. I would do that. We had 4 little children, and so I would put these little children in the car with me, and he was a bar drinker. It was necessary I find him. You know, my mother did. That's what you do with an alcoholic, you find him. And I was never quite sure what to do with him once I did find him, but I found him. And what we would do is, because he'd get irritated if I went in the bar after him, So what we would do is that we would find his car and then we would move it. Sometimes I would just move it around the block, or sometimes I'd move it to another bar, or, you know, just anywhere. You know, I would just move his car. And we'd get in the car and go home. Now, what that did, that gave me a great payoff, because I was in control of him then, you see. Because when he was ready to come home, he would have to call me and say, "Honey, I can't find my car." And I would say, "You can't what?" And he would say, "I can't find the car." And I said, "Well, I'll just come and get you." And so that was my payoff. I got to get the kids up again, and we'd get in the car, and I'd go after him at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I got something out of that, I guess. Anyway, we'd take him home and pour him home. And in the morning, he'd get up, and he'd have to be real humble when he asked me if I'd help him go look for the car. And we'd drive around for a while. You know, I'd make him suffer a little bit. And then when we'd find the car, it was just wonderful. Have you ever seen that look of peace and gratitude that comes over the face of an alcoholic when he's reunited with his vehicle? And I was responsible. But I learned to look for him from my mother. You know, and I think that my daughter picked up a lot of traits from me, more than I would have liked her to. And just like with my mother, some of the things I picked up from her haven't worked so well in my life, and that's okay, because I've been able to get rid of them. Anyway, growing up in this alcoholic home, there was a lot of craziness, and I knew right away, and we always knew it was alcoholism. There was never a doubt in any of our minds that it was alcoholism. He was a very, very bad alcoholic. And I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, where we just had the international, and what fun that was to go back for that. But that's where we grew up, and it was hard being the daughters of the town drunk when you're in Salt Lake City, you know, in this Mormon environment. But that's how I grew up, and I knew that I never wanted alcohol as part of my life. I knew that. And I wanted a nice home. I wanted a nice family. I wanted where there was not so much shame. You know, we all have the same feelings, I think, if you're here and you're in Al-Anon. We all have the same feelings, you know, the fear, the anger, the distrust, the confusion, hate, sorrow, pain. Those were all of the feelings that we experienced as we walked through this disease. And today our feelings are probably just pretty much the same too, you know, the joy, the happiness, the peace, serenity. Those are the feelings that we share today. And so I think our stories are really very, very much alike. I'll just kind of fill in the blanks as to how mine differs from yours a little bit. But I experienced all of those feelings of hate and distrust, and there was nothing about my father I liked. Drunk or sober, I did not like that man, and I knew I never wanted to marry anyone like him. But as with what happens normally in an alcoholic home, I was real anxious to get out of there, and my ticket out was to get married. So I got married very, very young, and I knew that a man would make me okay. Now, I will tell you that this was back in the 50s, and in those days, you had to marry a man. It was not okay just to have him. You had to marry him. And so I married him. That marriage did not last very long, I will tell you that. He was not an alcoholic, but you can be very, very sure that he had a few holes in his net, or he would never have been interested in me. And we didn't live together very long, but out of that marriage came a beautiful, beautiful baby boy. And so here I was, you know, I was 20 years old, had a baby, a divorce, and this was not what I had planned. You know, it wasn't what I had planned at all. I wanted a nice home. I wanted a nice family. I wanted to be respectable, because those were the things I never had growing up. So I got along for a while like this, and it was about this time that I met the God of my understanding, and he came into my life like a knight on a white horse. He just wrote into my life, and I knew from the moment I looked at him that he was the man that was mine. You know, later on I found out that he was a drunk riding a jackass, but... but when I saw him that night, he was my knight in shining armor. And I want to tell you about what it was like when we met. My birthday is July 1st, and his is July 2nd. Now, that would tell anyone that we should get married. We could have joint birthday parties. I also thought he was very, very intellectual. He had a subscription to Time magazine. And that just impressed the shoes off me. Yeah. And he was a journalist in the Navy, and I had written poems and poetry for years. I'd just written, you know, I was a real writer at that point, and he let me read to him my poetry. And so it was really a match made in heaven. It wasn't until years later that I began to think about it, and he was drunk that night. And it never occurred to me, that this was going against what I really wanted in my life. And as we went through our courtship, there was a lot of alcohol in our courtship. And I should have known that there was something wrong, but I thought it was with me. Because he would go out drinking, and I would drink with him, and... we'd go out to party, and the next morning I would say something to him about, how could you have said that to me last night? And he'd say, say what? And I'd tell him, he said, I didn't say that. And I thought, oh, okay. I thought you did, though. And later on, it became kind of a joke with him. He would say, now, what are you going to believe, what I tell you or what you saw? And well, of course I'm going to believe what you tell me, you know? I am. Anyway, he was a blackout drinker. You know, that should have been a hint. I had no idea what a blackout drinker was. If I did, I wouldn't have had to hide his car, would I? It would have saved a lot of trips. He would never have found it anyway. Anyway, we got married, and alcohol, we were really very, very happy, I think, for quite a long while. I don't know, 10 days, 2 weeks, something like that. Which is a very long time when you're living with a drunk alcoholic. And I began to see that he did have potential, but he was not quite measuring up yet. And we needed to have a baby, and he would become a responsible parent. Now, remember, I had this little boy, and now he has a wife and a baby, but I decided he needs a little more responsibility to help him come home at night, you know, and forget this going out and drinking. And so we had another baby, and again, you know, that potential was still there, but he didn't measure up. And so we had another one, and then we had another one. And... it occurred to me after the fourth one that perhaps that he wasn't going to be a responsible father. So we didn't do that anymore. I love it when we read the do's and don'ts in Al-Anon, and I think they ought to add one, you know, don't try and control alcoholism by childbirth, you know. But I tried to, but you know, that was the very best part of my life, was being a mom. I loved every minute of it. I loved being a mom. And I just, if I could just get him sober, you know, it would have been okay. But I didn't get him sober. You know, I told you I tried everything. And I thought, if he only understood how I felt, then he would not drink anymore. And it was me putting it in different ways, you know. If I told him outright, he didn't get it. Since I was a very visual person, I tried to think of ways I could demonstrate how bad it was for me. And we were sitting home one night, which was unusual that he was home drinking, because he normally drank out. Now I understand why, but at the time I didn't. But he generally did not drink at home, but he was home this particular night. And I was trying to explain to him how sorry my life was, you know, with him and his drinking. And I went on and on and on, you know, and I finally said, I am so miserable that if that gun was loaded, I would kill myself. And he said, well, don't let that stop you. And he loaded it. And it was a shotgun. And I think he put a rifle slug in it or something. I don't know. Anyway, I'd never shot a gun before in my life. And the thing knocked me on my can. And the bullet ricocheted all over the room. I mean, I was backed into a corner and I had to shoot the gun. You know, it never occurred to me to back down, you know, from what I was saying. And I look back on that now and I was just nuttier than a fruitcake. You know? And the thing about it is, he didn't even remember. It was about 2 weeks later, and we were sitting in the den looking at television, and he said, what happened to the paneling up there? He went over and looked at it. What happened to the carpet down here? And, you know, the carpet was all torn up. That was my grand suicide attempt, you know, and he missed it. And you know, my story is my reaction to alcohol and alcoholics. And in order to tell you about my reactions, it is necessary that I do tell you some of the alcoholics in my life. And I do that with their permission. I want you to know that because they have all publicly acclaimed themselves to be alcoholics. But I had blackouts. He had blackouts. I had blackouts. And I believe that's God's way of protecting us from too much pain too soon, because things came back to me slowly. We were, a couple of years ago, I guess, I was shopping in our local grocery store, and I put a pack of pork chops in the basket. And as I put them in the basket, I had this memory flood over me, and I just wanted to crawl under the meat counter. And I remembered something I had done. And it was real clear, like I had just done it yesterday. But he would call me when he was out. He would say, okay, honey, I stopped off to get a beer, and I'll be right home. And I was cooking pork chops this night for dinner. And he'd say, I'm just going to finish my beer, and I'll be right home. So I fixed the pork chops in the electric frying pan. And he didn't show up, so I turned him off. And pretty soon he'd call back and he'd say, honey, I just had another beer. He said, they're bringing it to me now, setting it right down in front of me, and I'll be right home as soon as I finish this. And I said, okay. So I turn the pork chops back on again, and he doesn't show up. I turn them back off again. And he calls and he says, don't be mad at me. I'll be right home. Okay. And I turn the pork chops on again, and he doesn't come home. I turn them off again. And I do this several times, and you know what happens when you do that with pork chops enough? They get really stiff. So I thought if he could understand how I feel about this. And so what I did was I took the pork chops out and I nailed them to the garage door. And you see, the reason I did that was that I thought he would drive up and he would see his dinner on the garage door, and he would understand what he had done to me. But now remember, old SOB, sweet old Bill, drank in a blackout, so he didn't know that. So guess who had to go out the next morning? You know, I go out the next morning, all the neighborhood dogs are, you know, jumping. And I'm the one who has to take the pork chops down, you know. And he missed it. We had, I was fixing breakfast for dinner one night recently, last month or so, just very recently, and he was late coming home, and he said, well, thank God you didn't try and nail the eggs to the garage door. I did not have a problem with the insanity when I got to the program. I'm going to tell you one more little story about what we did. When they announced the lost wallet last night, Bill nudged me and he said, I think maybe, did you take it? Because, you see, another thing we did was when he did get home, he didn't always get home when he went out, because sometimes he went to jail before he got home. But sometimes he got home. And when he got home, he would come in the bedroom and I'd be awake, and he'd turn on the light and tiptoe into the walk-in closet, and he would get undressed, and he would take his wallet out, and he would hide it. And he would hide it in the toe of a shoe or in the breast pocket of a coat, you know, in a shoe box, in, under the blankets that were in the top. And I'd always watch where he put his wallet. And then he would stumble into bed, and I would get up, and I'd turn the light on, and I'd go into the closet, and I'd retrieve the wallet from wherever he had put it, and I would take some money out of it. Now, I do want you to know I never, ever took all of his money. I just took some of it, and I always left him some, and then I would move the wallet to a different place. And then in the morning when he'd get up, I'd make sure as soon as he got up, I'd ask him for some money. And then I would always ask for just a little bit more than what I had left him, you know. And and then I would watch as he had to walk around the room and try and find his wallet. And the excuses he would make, you know, about where his wallet was. And we played those kinds of games, and I was right in there. I mean, I was right in there. And it was, you know, I was trying to make him crazy so he'd stop drinking. You know, everything hinged on him. Everything hinged on him being sober, because, you see, by this time our kids were getting pretty crazy too. The oldest one, oh my, he was a wonderful son. Everyone said, oh, you are so lucky to have a son like Michael. And I would smile and shake my head and say, thank you very much. But you see, what they didn't know is what happened when Mike came in the house, because there we didn't have a door in our house that he hadn't put his fist through. And he got straight A's in school, and all of the mothers in the neighborhood thought he was just wonderful. And he was on the honor roll, and he took care of the kids. He took care of his three younger brothers and sisters so I could concentrate on getting Dad sober, see. It took my full time to work on him. So Mike kind of took care of the rest of the children while I did this. And he beat the hell out of his brother all the time, you know, all the time. And I know today it was anger, but I didn't know what to do with it. Because, you see, if I could just get his dad sober, then it would be okay. It would be okay, because Dad could help me handle this problem then. But until then, we just had to pretend it didn't exist. And the second son, Bobby, well, Bobby was, by the time he was 15 or 16, he really had a problem with alcohol. And I, to this day, remember watching him walk down the street with his head hung low. He didn't drink to have fun, you see. He drank because he needed to. And the night he graduated from high school, we got a call from a neighbor who said, I think your son's dead. Somebody dumped him on our lawn this morning. They've taken him to the hospital, but I think he's dead. And we went to the hospital, and he was there with alcohol poisoning. And that was the night he graduated from high school, and he had a problem with alcohol. But you see, I couldn't take care of that because I was busy taking care of Dad to see if I could get him sober so he could help me with all of these problems that we had. And our third daughter, our oldest daughter, Kathy, she was just running around the house being the good kid. And we played the blame game in our house a lot. You know, every time anything happened, it didn't matter how we dealt with it. It was who we blamed for it. And I know that you have had homes like that too. You know, it was, we had to blame somebody for everything. And Kathy would always stand up and raise her hand and say, I did it. You know, anything to keep peace in our house, peace at any price. And that was what my daughter was doing. And one of the things that I had taken to doing for Bill when he was drinking was, when he did get home and he didn't get to jail, he sometimes didn't ever get in the house either. because he would drive up and he would go just as far as I guess the car would go, and sometimes he'd park in the yard or, you know, wherever, and then he would just relax. He would just felt like he had gone far enough. And at first I tried to bring him in the house, but even as though he's not a real big man, it's hard to handle a drunk like that. So what I did was I took his bed out to the car to him, and I brought the pillow and put his little head under the pillow, and I pushed the seat down, and I took his little shoes off so his feet wouldn't swell, and his glasses off because so he wouldn't break them, and I took his cigarettes and lighter because I didn't want him to hurt himself, and then I locked him in so nobody would steal him, and in the morning, you know, you'd see him get up and he'd have his little pillow under his arm and dragging his blankie behind him, and the school bus stopped in front of our house, and so this was what the kids got to see every morning when they went to school, and then all the kids would go out to the car and go through the car and pick up the change. You know, there was, you know, it was kind of a good deal. But anyway, our daughter, Kathy, she would start calling her dad when she got home from school, and she'd call his office, and if he wasn't in his office yet, she knew he had had a long lunch hour, and she would get the pillow and blankets out and put them by the front door for me because she knew that he was drunk that night. And she became more like me than I ever wanted her to be. And our youngest daughter, Kelly, well, she was cute and funny, and she was getting in trouble. She was getting kicked out of school, and she was a mess. She was just a mess. But I could, you see, I knew all of these things, but I couldn't do anything about it because I knew that if Bill were sober, he could help me with this. So I propped him up so I could lean on him. And I needed him. I needed him just the way he was because he needed me. And that's the way we lived our life. Alcohol took me places I never wanted to go. It made me do things I never wanted to do. The first time Bill went to jail, I remember that. I remember so well what it was like when the first time he went to jail and I went to get him out. I was humiliated. I was embarrassed. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to call. I didn't know any of these things, and it was a humiliating, embarrassing thing. And I remember walking in there with my head hung low, you know, talking to the bail bondsman and trying to put money together to get him out of jail, and the shame that I felt when I did that. And, you know, 20 years later, the last time I went to get him out of jail, it was no big deal. It was no big deal. I knew exactly where to go, and I knew exactly what to do because I had done it lots of times before, and it was no longer a big deal. And that's the sad thing, I think, about the disease, is that it takes the dignity and it takes the self-respect out of you. And I did it willingly. I compromised every principle I had in the name of getting him sober. And I think that's the sad part about it. Anyway, I finally decided to leave that marriage, and I don't know where the courage to do so came from, but I did. I left that marriage, and I left him, the drunk house, the drunk son, and the dishes, the silverware, the pots and pans, the bedding, because, you see, I could start over again. I didn't want anything in the past because I was going to get away from alcoholism and I was going to be okay. So I took the two daughters and our Star Wars glasses and Grandma's china and three knives and three forks and three spoons, and we moved and we left. And this was the beginning of my end because, you see, all those years I had been able to pin my unhappiness on his drinking. And if it wasn't his drinking, then it was my dad's drinking. All my life, everything I had done wrong, I had been able to nail on an alcoholic. And by this time, our oldest son had left home. And I left the drunk one with Bill, and I guess they didn't know what it was like to live together. You know, the police had come, and they didn't know whether it was for father or for son, you know. But anyway, I wasn't there, and I didn't have to worry about it. So I thought we were supposed to live happily ever after, but you know, I took me with me, and I didn't live happily ever after. And Kelly kept getting in more and more and more trouble, and I was transferred with my job to Louisiana. And she was kicked out of school there. I used to say she had some problems in school. Well, she did. She was kicked out. That was the problem. And so I decided that I couldn't do anything. I was at the end of my rope, and I hear alcoholics talk about being saved from death by the program, and I know today that I was. Suicide was always an option for me. It was always an option. And so I went through the phone book. She had stolen my company car. I was driving a company car, and she had taken my company car. And I knew that if I lost my job, you know, everything was going to fall apart. And so I called. We were living in Lafayette, Louisiana, and I went through the phone book, and I went down, and I found the names of psychologists, and I called one after the other after the other after the other to try and find somebody who could help this daughter of mine. And my heart was breaking, and I knew that I couldn't go on like I was, and I knew that the only thing I could do was check out, was suicide. I knew that that was the only thing I could do. And so I finally found one that called me back, and I said, can you see her right now? And he said, well, yes, well, just come on in. And I said, well, I don't know where she is. I can't find her, you know. He said, come in by yourself, and we'll talk, and we'll see if I have the skills that she may need. So I went in, and I talked to him. And he said, tell me a little bit about you. And so I told him about Kelly and the problems I was having with Kelly. And he said, well, tell me a little bit about you. So then I told him about Bobby, you know, that was her brother, and the problems he was having. And he said, well, tell me a little bit about you. And then I told him about Bill. And, you know, here I am, a single mother, trying to raise this terrible daughter, and my husband's drunk, and, you know. And so we covered my father, and then he said, well, tell me a little bit about you. And for the first time that I can ever remember, I began to tell someone a little bit about me and how I felt. Now, I will promise you, it has not been with the depth and the honesty that I have talked to you today, but I began to tell him a little bit about me. And at the end of the hour, it was as though he had been looking through the windows right into my soul. And he said, you know, what you have is this family disease of alcoholism. And he began to describe alcoholism to me. And he said, would you be willing to do something to make yourself well? And he said, you know, you can come back and see me a couple of times a week for $60 a pop, or you can go to Al-Anon, because that's where you belong. You know, that's been almost 20 years ago. And I don't know that that would happen today, but isn't that a miracle? You know, he didn't ask for my Blue Cross card. He didn't get treatment. He didn't do anything except tell me I needed to go to Al-Anon. And then he made a phone call, and he told a lady on the other end, I have a lady here in my office who needs an Al-Anon meeting tonight. Could you meet her? And he set up this meeting for me to go to my very first Al-Anon meeting that night. And that was the 13th of November of 1978. And I went to my first meeting that night. Well, I went to my first meeting, but I missed it. Because, you see, he told me that there were people there who felt just like I did. And so when I went to I looked in the first room, and it was all lighted, and there were a bunch of mostly men in there. And they were slapping each other on the back and hugging and smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. I could tell they were alcoholics. And I went to the next room, and there were mostly women in there, and they were hugging each other and drinking coffee and smiling. And I walked all the way around the church, because, you see, he told me that the people in Al-Anon would feel exactly like I did. And I didn't see anyone in that room that felt exactly like I did, so I thought that I was in the wrong place. And I went home without going to my first meeting. I called him the next day, and he told me indeed that there had been a meeting, and I had missed it. And I did make a meeting that night, and that was the 14th of November of 1978. I had no expectations about Al-Anon. I was beat right down to a nub. I was absolutely and completely powerless, and I knew it. And because I wanted to live about that much more than I wanted to die, I kept going. And I was really a mess. I mean, I was just such a mess. I couldn't even say my name. You know, they would call on me in a meeting, and I couldn't even say my name. I would just shake my head. I did that for probably 4 months. The only thing I did right was I kept coming back. But, you know, I kept thinking, if y'all find out what I'm really like, you won't let me stay. Because I had lost all of my self-respect at that time. I had lost all my self-esteem. But you see, when you don't do esteemable things, you lose it. And I was not doing esteemable things. And what a gift that was, to come into the program and learn that I could have my self-respect back. But I kept coming back. Well, now, about this time, sweet old Bill was in Chicago. He had been transferred to Chicago. It was like when we were together and married, you know, we'd get in a fight and I'd say, I'm going to go sleep on the couch. And he'd say, don't bother, I am. And, you know, we'd both go sleep on a different couch. Nobody slept in the bed. And when we separated, you know, I said, well, I'm leaving this town and I go to Louisiana. He says, don't bother, I'm leaving. And so he goes to Chicago and we both leave the town. You know, that's how we lived. And he called me one night and he said, about 3:30 in the morning, and he said, honey, it's going to be all right. He said, I joined AA and I'm okay. Everything is going to be okay. And I said, you lousy son of a gun, don't you ever call me at 2:30 in the morning again. And I hung up on him. But in fact, he had called AA and he was getting sober. It had nothing to do with me. He didn't know anything that I was in Al-Anon or anything. And I kept going to meetings, and little by little, I was learning. I didn't do well because the one phrase I heard was, take what you like and leave the rest. And now that I remembered. And I thought, well, I don't want anything to do with God, because at this point, God had really let me down. Every prayer I had ever uttered in my entire life had been, God, please get an alcoholic sober. God, please make my father not hit us. God, please make my father stop drinking. God, please help Bill to not drink. Those were my prayers. That was all I ever asked for. And my God had not done that. So I did not want to stay around where God, you talked about God, but I heard, take what you like and leave the rest. And so I left God. I did all the rest of the steps one night. And which are the kinds of things you do when you don't have a sponsor, you see. When you don't talk to people and learn about the program, those are the kinds of things you do. So I did the steps one night. And all the ones that didn't have anything to do with God, because I didn't want to do that. But, you know, I kept coming back, and I kept coming back. And that was the joy and the blessing of it. And, you know, I finally did get into the program, because what happened was, the way Al-Anons do, you know, they kind of block the door after you've done that so long, and you have to, they make you talk, and then they take you to coffee and things like that. And then they take you to open AA meetings. And, oh, wow, was I ever surprised. You see, I did not know alcoholics hurt. I did not know that. I thought he always drank at me. And I did not know that he hurt. And so what a blessing that was for me to go to open AA meetings. And I still do, and I love it, because I learned so much from alcoholics, and I love alcoholics. That's always been my problem. I love alcoholics. And he was in AA. By this time, our daughter was in a treatment center in Kansas. And part of her program was that we had to go from different to every 6 weeks for this family thing. And so he would go from Chicago and I'd go from Lafayette. We'd meet in Kansas. And first we stayed in separate motels. Now, he tells it differently, but I know that the way I tell it is the way it happened. He says we stayed in separate hotels, and then we stayed in separate rooms, and then we stayed in separate beds. But that's not, you know, I wouldn't do that. But anyway, we hadn't ever gotten divorced, see, because, well, the reason we didn't get divorced was because when he got in AA, he got a girlfriend, and I don't know, she was some young thing, I don't know. She was half my age, is the truth, and she had firm thighs and all of that, and I hated her, and so when we'd meet in Kansas, I'd say, "Oh, did you get a babysitter for your girlfriend, huh?" And I'd say, "Well, you can marry her a doctor." And so I wouldn't give him a divorce. You know, if he wanted one, he'd have to do it himself and pay for it, because I wasn't going to pay for that little twit. Oh, that made me mad. Anyway, we did never get divorced. And so, you know, I believe that every time an alcoholic gets sober, it is a miracle. I really believe that with all of my heart. But God, I needed a miracle in my life, too. And my miracle came when I did my fourth step. Because, you see, before then, all of my hopes were pinned on an alcoholic sobriety. All of my dreams, everything I did was pinned on an alcoholic sobriety. And it was through my fourth and fifth step that I found out that I had a choice, you know? I had a choice. And I could take action. And that was where my miracle came, because, you see, as long as it was somebody else's fault, I couldn't do anything about it. But when I knew that I could do something, I was set free. And that's when my life began. And it came with my fourth and fifth steps. And finally, I was able to make amends to that man. And we were in Kansas in a rented car. And I remember I began to make my amends to him. And I had a list. And I was telling him some of the things that I had done and the ways I had taken advantage of him. And he would say, "Yes, but, you know," and he was trying to make it okay for me. And I said, "But you see, you just have to listen. It doesn't have to be okay for me. I am doing what I need to do for me." And, well, after a while, we began to talk for the first time in our lives. We hadn't done a lot of talking, and because there had been alcohol in the way. And we began to talk, and we realized that we did still love each other. You know, the first time we got married... The first time we got married, he took me to Tijuana because, you see, I was this nice girl that, well, actually, see, I was really horny, but I would, but I wouldn't do it unless we were married. So he took me to Tijuana and married me, and then the ring turned green on my finger, you know, and. And so then after that, we had a real wedding. And so those were two times that we were married. And so anyway, when we decided that we did want to go back together, it was, I guess, I had been in the program about 3.5 years at that time. And so what we decided to do was, since we couldn't afford a divorce, we would use the money for a wedding and a honeymoon. And that's what we did. And even though we had never been divorced, we had a wedding, and it was a wonderful wedding. Our oldest son walked me down the aisle, and the one who said he would dance on his dad's grave, well, he stood as his man's best man. And I looked so pretty that day. I've never looked prettier. I had a white dress on, and I had a flower in my hair, and I looked so pretty. I know that. And we were beginning this life together as new people, not as people who had gone back and picked up the broken pieces to a broken marriage. And it just keeps getting better. Just every day it keeps getting better. You know, here I am, this very old woman up here with all these raging hormones. And you know, life is wonderful. Life is wonderful. It's better than I could ever have dreamed. And the gifts that I have are the result of Al-Anon. Everything I am, everything I have, I am absolutely a product of Al-Anon. You see, I knew nothing about being a wife, And in my Al-Anon meetings, I learned how to be a wife. And that's not because we stand around and talk about what wives do. It was because you taught me how to apply the principles of the program in my marriage and in my life every day, one day at a time. And I was able to become a good wife. And I was able to become a good mother. And again, because I could use the traditions that I had learned in Al-Anon in my home. And I became a grandmother, and I was a wonderful grandmother, too. And what a blessing that is. But you see, all of these things were the result of what you taught me in Al-Anon and how to be a gracious and dignified lady. And I didn't have to do those crazy things anymore. I want to tell you, bring you up to date with what's going on, because that's the very, very best part of my story, is what's going on today. Our oldest son, Michael, he lives in Charlotte with his lovely wife and two beautiful grandchildren, and the guy that pushed the vacuum cleaner around and that was on the honor roll and all of that. Well, he finally made it. He's a doctor today, and he's a fine physician. He's a family practice doctor, and he's identifying alcoholism at the primary level and treating it, you know, just like I thought he would. You know, he said, Mom, if anybody would have looked at our family's medical history, they would have known that alcoholism was a problem. So now he is doing that, and he is doing it successfully, and he is a wonderful doctor, and more important, he is a gentle man. And there's no more of that man that was sticking his fist and feet through the doors and windows and beating the hell out of his brother. He is a wonderful, wonderful dad. He's a wonderful husband, and he is a gentle man. And he married a girl that our start was rocky because I was afraid I would never measure up. See, I was so afraid of her because she was so beautiful, and she was, I was afraid I would never measure up to what she deserved. And today we have a wonderful, loving relationship. My second son, well, I can't take the credit for what Michael has done with his life and him being a doctor, because then I would have to take the responsibility for our next son, Bobby. Bobby is sober today with the help of the Texas Corrections Facility. And he has been trying many, many years to get sober, and he has not made it. The first time he went to prison, I thought my heart would break. And, you know, I watched by, and I would see my reflection in the mirror as I would walk by, and I would think, you don't look like you have a son in prison. I know, I don't know what I thought that you should look like, that I didn't look like I should have. Would you think so? When I would go see him, you know, the first time I went to see him in prison, I put on my rattiest jeans, and I, you know, I wanted to blend in, And I went, and I found out I was the worst dressed person there, and I was able to go to see my son in prison, and I was able to learn to love him where he was, and that was such a gift, and that was the gift of Al-Anon. And you know, I never ever had to say to Bill, will you go with me to see Bobby? I knew that relationship was in God's hands. And Bill had a rocky relationship with all of our kids, but I knew that there was nothing I could do about that. You see, the only thing I can do is keep my side of the street clean and to treat my husband with dignity and respect every day of my life and not find fault with him and criticize him. And that's what I learned in Al-Anon. And I would go visit him, and one day Bill said, well, I think I would like to go with you to visit Bobby, and that was a little prayer answered. And I wanted to tell you how very much that meant to me, because I think sometimes when our own family is trying to get sober, it's harder for us to deal with that. He did get out of prison, and he was out for 6 months before he went back again. And this is all the result of alcohol and drug abuse. He went back to prison because he stole a camera. He stole a camera from a drugstore in order that he could buy more booze. And that's where alcoholism took him. It took our family places we never wanted to go. and doing things we never wanted to do. And I know he never wanted to go to prison. And that's where he is today. And I can love him where he is. And I can pray for him. And I can be sad for him. Now, our oldest daughter, Kathy, well, she's married, and she didn't marry an alcoholic. I do not know how she missed it. She sure should have, because she is her mother's daughter. But she married a neat guy. He's wonderful. They have two beautiful children, and we're so proud of them. They're happy. She called me, I guess it was maybe a year or two ago, she called me at work one day, and she said, which was real surprising. I was real worried when she called me at work, and she said, "Mom, I have to tell you something really, really, really important." And I said, "What is that, honey?" And she said, "Remember that chocolate cake that you used to bake when we were kids?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I really hated it." And she said, "Every time you come to my house, you make that chocolate cake, and my kids hate it, my husband hates it." And I just wanted you to know, I think it's important that we can be honest with each other. And I said, "Well, thank you for sharing." And so our relationship took on a new dimension. I don't know what we're going to do next. I guess maybe walk on the beach arm in arm and talk about feminine hygiene. Every time I bake a chocolate cake, I call her. I wanted to send her one for Christmas. I really did. And our daughter, Kelly, our little daughter, the youngest, the one that was in treatment when we got back together, well, she has struggled. She has been in more treatment centers than I could count on my hands and toes and your hands and toes. She has just been in all of them, and she has struggled so with the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction, more with drug addiction. She lived on the street in New Orleans for 4 years, which is a very, very long time to live on the streets in New Orleans for a young woman. And that was a very difficult time for us. She had a child. She was married to someone that she met in AA, that Bill sponsored, and I think she married him to get back at Bill, or you know how those minds work. I don't know, it had something to do with that. But they got married, and they had this wonderful little child, and when the baby was 6 weeks old, she came to me and she said, "Mom, I started using again. And would you keep the baby for a while until I can get on my feet?" And I said, "Yes, I will." And so we kept the baby for a while. And then she would come and she'd say, "I need money. And you got to give me money." And I would say, "No, Kelly, we cannot give you money." And she would say, "I'll take the baby away." And I would say, "You can't do that. You don't have a place to live. You know. And she would call the police. And the police would say, "Yes, you must give her the baby." And she would be higher than the kite, and I wouldn't understand that. And this went on and on. And then she would take the baby, and she'd bring him back, and she'd take him and bring him back. Finally, I guess when he was about a year and a half old, I guess, somewhere around in there, we had him most of the time. My fear, you know, how we go off into this fear of the unknown. And I had always thought, what if she takes him somewhere and loses him? Or what if she sells him? You know, and these are real crazy things that go through the mind of a grandparent. And I suppose a parent also. But you know, I kept thinking, it is our problem. You know, and I have learned through Al-Anon, when I have to face a problem, to do it in three phases, and that is to first ask myself, is it my business? And I asked myself that, and yes, it was my business. And the second is there anything I can do about it today? And most of the time, there is nothing I can do about it today if it is my business, and usually it's not. And the third question is will the action I take make me like myself better tomorrow? And usually the answer is no. or would I be proud to tell my sponsor? And that answer is usually no. But in this case, we knew that we had to take action because we got a call from her boyfriend who said, well, listen, I've got the baby. Somebody called my mother's house at 1 o'clock in the morning and said that she had left this kid here, and they found a phone number in the diaper bag. And all the fears that I had had came to fruition that moment. And on a Sunday afternoon, we called an attorney, and we knew we had to take action to protect that baby because he was a victim at that point. We went to court, and I can tell you that that was the most difficult thing I have ever done in my life. It was the very most difficult thing. But you see, she was so in the depths of drug addiction and what she was doing, and I knew that she could not take care of the baby. And so we went to court, and we went to court surrounded with our loving circle of friends in Al-Anon and AA. And I remember us standing in the parking lot as we went in, and one of my best friends from Al-Anon was with us as we walked to the courthouse, and we stopped and prayed and invited God into the courthouse. And I knew whatever happened, it was going to be okay because God was invited into it. And we were given temporary custody of him, and she went back to New Orleans and lived on the street. And when I tell you she lived on the street, I want to tell you that how difficult that is for a mom. You know, she would come back to town occasionally and call me, and I remember one time I met her in downtown Houston where she wanted me to meet her, and she was barefoot, and she had on holy jeans, and she probably weighed 80 pounds, and stringy hair, and open sores all over her body, and she was trying to get me to give her money, and my friends in Al-Anon talk about, you know, I don't know if I'm going to finance my child's next semester in school. He's got a C average. You know, I don't know whether I'm going to continue sending him to college or not. You know, and my dilemma was to whether to give my kid $24 so she could get a room for the night. And those are the kinds of things that we face when we deal with drug addiction and alcoholism. And about that time, this great big guy came down the street, and I guess he looks like I looked like I may have a quarter or two in my pocket, and he stopped me and he asked me for money, and she looked at him with all that bravado of the street, and she said, "Make it on down the road, man. I was hustling her first." And that's what I was at that moment. And I knew at that moment that that's what I was. I was just being hustled. I know that that's not where she wanted to be, and I know that that's not what she wanted to do, but that's where the disease had taken her and had taken me. Well, anyway, we still are raising this little guy. He is now 9 years old. He just had his 9th birthday party. We had a sleepover for 14 9-year-olds. And we will never, ever do that again. We are just, I mean, he gives us so much. He gives us so much. He is a wonderful, wonderful child, and we know that God had a hand in that because we have just given him to God, you know. And the theme of this conference, we're all in this together, you know, and that's how we have looked at raising this little kid. We don't know anything about being a parent. I mean, look how we screwed it up. We don't know anything, but all of us together do. And we just watch you, and we watch people in our home groups that have young children, and then we do what they do. And I've said for a very long time, longer than when it's been popular, that it takes the whole village to raise the child. And our village of AA and Al-Anon are raising this little kid, and they're doing a darn good job. You know, he's a good kid. When he was in kindergarten, his teachers told me, she said, "You know, he has the highest self-esteem of any child in this room. And I want you to know they could have told me anything that would not make me as proud of that as that." Because isn't that what it's all about? Because we did not do esteemable things, and our child was learning how to do them. He calls me Mom, and Bill's dad were the only parents he has really ever known. He knows his mom, and he calls her Kelly. He knows his other mom and calls her Kelly, and they don't see each other very often, but we're real open to that, you know, because we want to do what's right for him. And one day he was asking me, he said, well, if you're Mike's mom and you're Kathy's mom and you're my mom, then that would make Mike and Kathy my brother and sister. And I said, well, you have a point. And so when he went to bed that night, he said, please, Brett, bless all of my aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters, even though they're all the same people. My story is one of miracles, and I am going to wind up real quickly by telling you about some of the miracles in my life. As we got to realize that Joshua was going to school, and this was a huge responsibility we had taken on, and we knew that the important things that we could leave this child would be a spiritual foundation and a good education, but we hadn't counted on doing this. And I just said about this when he was going to kindergarten, just like I do anything else, you know, with gusto. And I decided he should go to a private school. So I made inquiries and I got registration forms. And I went to visit, you know, like I had money to do it with. But I just pushed ahead, you know, like we do. You know, just don't ever look at what we're doing. And I don't know where I thought we were going to get the money from, but we... every time you register, you know, or ask to be tested, it costs money, and it was like $200, and we didn't really have it, but I had made the appointment for him to be tested at this one little private school. And so on a Thursday night before the test on Saturday, I was sitting there by myself feeling really peaceful and serene and not worried, and a knock came at the door, and a friend of mine that we know, you know, and I know you know the kind of friend I'm talking about. We don't see each other often, but when we do, we just kind of pick up where we left off, and you don't have to talk on the phone between times. You know, you're close in the heart. And she came to the door, and she said, well, what's going on? And I said, well, you're just not going to believe what my deal is now. My deal is I'm trying to find a private school for Joshua to go to. And, I mean, he's going into kindergarten. And she said, you won't believe what I've come here for. She said, I sat straight up in my bed at 1 o'clock in the morning this morning and thought, I've done all this praying and talking, and I haven't talked to Jan and Bill. And she said, I have a lot of money. She said, I have a lot of money. Now, I did not know that. I did not have any idea. And she said, and my husband and I would consider it a privilege if you would allow us to pay for Joshua's education. And she said, however, there is one string attached to that. And I said, what is that? And she said, you must never, ever, ever tell anyone. I must always remain anonymous. You know, she said, everything that we have is a gift of God through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And if we can't share it with our family, then we should not be entrusted with the money. And she said, so we would consider it an honor if you would allow us to educate Joshua. She said, you have the hard part. You get up every day and you put on the mama hat. And she said, we would consider that a privilege. Now, folks, where else would that happen? And this is not just for kindergarten, or not for first, second, third, and fourth grade, but she has set up an educational fund for him and to pay for his education forever long. He goes to school, and whether he wants to be a doctor or a lawyer, an astronaut, whatever. And that child's education is taken care of. And where else but in AA and Al-Anon? And what a miracle, you know? And it's all we had to do was just to suit up and show up and to continue serving each other and serving the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon to the best of our ability. So we get to make amends to our own children now as they see us be different in the situation. You know, if you can't change the situation, you can change yourself in the situation. And today we are good parents, and we are good grandparents. And I'd marry him again if he'd ask me. I wear this little necklace that Bill gave me for Christmas. I have a favorite story that I want to end with. And it really describes about me and my journey through Al-Anon. And the story is an Indian story about how the lion came out of the jungle, and he stood and looked over the fields as he looked out of the jungle and let out a mighty roar. And he peeked over the fields and he saw some sheep in the valley, and in the middle of these sheep was a little lion cub, and the sheep were all making sheep noises like baa, you know. And he looked over, and the little lion cub was going baa, and he walked over and he walked through the flock of sheep, and he picked up the little lion cub by the scruff of his neck, and he said, why are you making sheep sounds? You're a lion. And he said, no, I'm not. I'm a sheep. And he took him over to the pond, and he held him over the pond, and he said, look in the pond, see who you are, see your reflection. And the little lion cub looked in, and he saw he was a lion, and he let out a mighty roar. And I believe that that's what's happened to me in Al-Anon. You see, I was really always a precious child of God, but I didn't know it. And it took you holding me over the pond and showing me my reflection in the pond that made me realize that I am a precious child of God and I have a mighty roar. Thank you so much for allowing me to be here.